Do you remember the Eurovision Song Contest 1974? Do you remember ABBA and their victory for Sweden with the song Waterloo? Do you remember Gianola Cinquetti and her attempt at a second victory for Italy? Do you remember when Luxembourg was too cheap and got the UK to host the contest for them? If there is one thing you do need to remember, it's this. Remember you're a womble. This is ESC 101. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to ESC 101, your home of Eurovision history and obscurity. This is the podcast where we take a look at the Eurovision Song Contest throughout the years to uncover the story behind the world's largest international televised music competition. Welcome to episode 17. My name is Alexander. For those of you who celebrate, I'd like to wish you a Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy belated Hanukkah, or happy holidays for those who celebrate other traditions. For those of you who celebrate festivities, and for those of you who prefer to spend December a little bit more quietly, I hope you enjoy this time together as we explore Eurovision history and obscurity. Let's dive into the story behind the Wombles. If you're like me and have watched the 1974 Eurovision Song Contest, I'm sure plenty of moments come to mind. Of course, there's the aforementioned ABBA and Gianola Cinquetti. Olivia Newton-John represented the UK. Greece debuted in Eurovision for the first time. But how many of you remember the Wombles? I certainly don't, and it's not just because I'm Canadian and not British. The Wombles are fascinatingly obscure for me. Perhaps those of you who are British might be familiar with the Wombles, but for the rest of us, they remain shrouded in mystery, especially how they became the interval act of the Eurovision Song Contest in 1974. Today, I'm going to tell you all about the Wombles, their creator, and what it means to be a Womble, because remember, you too can be a Womble. The Wombles are the creation of children's book author Elizabeth Beresford. Her story is actually quite fascinating. She was born on August 6, 1926, in Paris, France, daughter of John Davies Beresford, 1873-1947, and Evelyn Beatrice Oford Roxhams, 1880-1975, Elizabeth's family is English, and they had moved to Paris to avoid the Inland Revenue, which is a department of the British government that was responsible for the collection of direct taxation, including some income tax, inheritance tax, and more. That's right, Elizabeth's parents were tax dodgers, at least according to an interview done by The Times Online. I'll post a link to the article on the show notes for this episode on the ESC 101 website. Elizabeth's father was very well connected in the literary world. He was friends with authors such as D.H. Lawrence, George Bernard Shaw, Hugh Walpole, and most notably H.G. Wells, the author of The Time Machine, The War of the Worlds, The Red Room, and much more. Elizabeth, as a child, recalls the few moments that she actually interacted with Wells. The Times Online article quotes, "Lisa remembers Wells as a small man with a loud voice. He was rather stern and didn't suffer fools gladly. Despite having the most famous writers of the age around her, Lisa had little chance to speak to any of them. In those days, as a child, I was kept very separate. Children were seen and not heard. I was brought in to see my parents for an hour at tea time. That was it." When Elizabeth was young, family drama ensued, as her father went off with another woman when she was young. Her mother moved the family to Brighton, where they took on lodgers to make money for the family. Elizabeth secretly wrote to her father until his death in 1947, but apparently her mother burnt the letters when she found them years later. Talk about a grudge. But I guess from the mother's perspective, an unfaithful husband carries little value. During the Second World War, Elizabeth served in the Women's Royal Naval Service, also known as the Wrens, working as a wireless telegraphist. After the war, she worked as a ghostwriter specializing in speeches. She eventually began training as a journalist, writing for radio, film, and television columns. Her career takes her to the BBC, where she begins working as a BBC radio reporter and meets her future husband, BBC tennis commentator and broadcaster Max Robertson. They ended up getting married in 1949 and had two children together, a son Marcus and a daughter Kate. Her career in children's novels began during trips to Australia, South Africa, and the West Indies. Elizabeth managed to create a few stories, including a novel and two television series, but she was having difficulty coming up with the idea well into the 1960s. Then, her career took a dramatic turn when she created The Wombles. The story of how The Wombles came into being is quite amusing, and I'll let Elizabeth tell you the story through her quote in the Times Online article. Quote, "I had both my mother and my parents-in-law staying in our home in Wandsworth one Christmas. My two children were going mad by Boxing Day because I kept telling them not to make a noise as Granny was asleep or Granddad was trying to read. So we drove to Wimbledon Common, and the three of us just let go. We tore up and down on the grass shouting and screaming at the top of our voices. My daughter Kate come up to me and says, 'Ma, isn't it great on Wimbledon Common?' And I thought, that's it. That's where the Wombles come from." The characters are based on her own family. Great Uncle Bulgaria is based on her father-in-law, Tobermory on her brother, Orinoco on her son, and Madame Chollet Coburg Womble was inspired by her royalty-obsessed mother. The names of the characters come from a variety of geographic-inspired sources close to Elizabeth's life, including the town where her daughter Kate went on a French exchange, and the name of a college attended by a nephew. At this point, you're probably wondering exactly what the Wombles are. Basically, Wombles are pointy-nosed furry creatures who live in burrows, working to help the environment by collecting and recycling trash, or as the British call it, rubbish, in different creative ways. Wombles live around the world, but the story's focused on those who live in the burrow on Wimbledon Common, where Elizabeth had that faithful inspiration. There is a cute little fact that residents of Wimbledon complained to authorities that children were being influenced to leave litter on the common in the hopes of seeing a womble emerge and pick it up. That to me is the most adorable thing, and I imagine one of their songs, which was the song featured for the Interval Act, helped to inspire kids to pick up litter rather than create it. The Wombles' motto is, "Make good use of bad rubbish," which was pretty revolutionary considering environmental activism was in its infancy during that time. The Wombles even organized Womble cleaning up groups, which helped promote environmental responsibility to children. Wombles are herbivores. They are fond of mushrooms, eating a variety of plants, fungi, and tree products that humans can't eat. Examples of some food that they eat include daisy buns, moss pie, acorn juice, fir cone souffle, elm bark casserole, and grass bread sandwiches. Sounds delicious. Wombles are also unique to certain environments. The Loch Ness Monster, for example, is actually a womble, part of a clan of water wombles. There are also yeti wombles who live in the Himalayan mountains. Wombles have a sixth sense, which allows them to sense green spaces and wildlife, and they take an active interest in fostering their communities, teaching young wombles reading, writing, and athletic skills. Womble names are bestowed upon those who reach working age, and the names are given by Great Uncle Bulgaria's large atlas, where the individual flips through the pages until they find a name that suits them. Wombles are generally fearful of humans, keeping their existence a secret from humans to avoid the great womble hunt.
Anyway, back to the question of food.
Oh, yeah. Hang on. This is Wimbledon Common, isn't it?
Yes.
Hey, I wonder how much meat you get on a womble.
Eddie, wombles don't exist.
Oh, yes, they do. I've seen them on the telly.
Eddie, would it scar you for life if I told you they were just puppets?
Yes, it would.
Good. Eddie, they were just puppets.
Well, what's that then?
Eddie, that is a hedgehog.
No, it's not. That is Great Uncle Bulgaria.
Well, if it's Great Uncle Mulgary, then the series has taken a sad turn for the worse, because he's wandering about in the nude.
Oh, the Wombles have got X-rated.
Anyway, pop your insane, leaking brain back in its sponge bag for just an instant and concentrate. Now, Womble or not, that is our supper.
It'll be a bit spiky, won't it?
They don't like adult humans very much, but they do hold a high regard for royalty, especially Queen Elizabeth II. And they have a respect for human literature, with Great Uncle Bulgaria enjoying the Times newspaper, and Wombles maintaining a generally large library of books left behind. Despite their poor opinion of humans in general, they are never unkind to humans or other animals, and they work to help keep the planet clean. The first Wombles book was published in 1968. Illustrated by Margaret Gordon, 1939 to 1989. With Elizabeth's literary background, her work was easily recognized in the world of authors and novelists. Ultimately, there were over 20 Wombles books translated into more than 40 different languages, along with 30 TV films and a Wombles stage show. Her book was featured on Jackanory, a BBC television children's series which ran from 1965 to 1996, focusing on promoting an interest in reading to children, involving an actor reading to children from an armchair. 10 Wombles books were featured on the program, with all of the stories being read by Ronald Hines, in episodes 865 to 869, broadcasted from December 29, 1969 to January 2, 1970, and in episodes 1125 to 1129, broadcasted from March 22 to the 26th, 1971. After the initial success of the Wombles on Jackanory, the BBC decided to approach Elizabeth to turn the Wombles into an animated series, beginning in 1973. The BBC commissioned the production company Filmfare to create a stop-motion television series directed by Ivor Wood, with the characters being voiced by Bernard Cribbins. Two series of 30 episodes were produced, lasting 5 minutes each, running from 1973 to 1975. As the TV series was being created, Filmfare approached songwriter and record producer Mike Batt to produce a theme song for them. Mike's story is actually a bit tragic regarding the Wombles. In an interview done by Neil McCormick, Mike describes his struggle to be taken seriously in the art world after his work with the Wombles. Quote, "Before the Wombles, I was making a living as an arranger, doing credible stuff. I did strings for Traffic. Even John Peel used to pop around to see what I was up to. Always pre-Womble. Post-Womble, I never heard from him again." In the 1970s, aged 23, he was married with children, and he had blown £11,000 on recording half a rock orchestral album that was never released. He was basically at his rock bottom, and he was looking for any kind of work. He was approached and offered a £200 fee, but instead he asked for the character rights to the Wombles for musical production, and the company, in poor hindsight, agreed, believing the Wombles were, quote, not worth anything. Mike's mother ended up making a Wombles costume for him using old plastic washing up mats and a black ping pong ball for the nose. Mike Batt created a band sharing the Wombles' name, originally running from 1973 to 1976. It was featured on Cilla Black's BBC television series, and the band released several albums and singles, reaching the top 10 in the UK charts. Mike basically used the Wombles to stabilize himself financially, and once he was stable, he moved on to work on other projects. Interestingly, Mike Batt eventually ended up collaborating with George Harrison of the Beatles, and his attitude towards the Wombles improved over time, or so I thought, before learning that in 2022, Mike Batt destroyed the multi-track tapes from the Wombles' recording sessions so the music could not be remixed after his death. I'm sorry, but that was extremely rude of him, and that's me saying it nicely. In an article written by Ali Schulter for NME, Mike Batt said, "Do you think the Eagles would want Hotel California remixed when they're dead and gone? What's wrong with it as it is? What if the next generation came along and said, John Constable was a great painter, but these days we like to use a different color for water, so let's just paint over that." First off, in that scenario, the Eagles would be dead. No one would be around to complain about it. no one is suggesting that there's anything wrong with Hotel California. In fact, people love it so much that they want to use it to support their own creative endeavors. In my opinion, people should be free to remix music in creating new pieces of art. Music artists do it literally all the time. They sample songs that are decades or even centuries old. Second off, your painting argument is absolute nonsense. No one is suggesting to paint over an original piece. Artists just want to create something new. No one's replacing anything. People make parodies, covers, and completely new pieces deriving inspiration from old music. In a conversation with Paul McCartney, Paul asks Mike, "How many versions of Get Back do people need to hear?" Sir Paul McCartney, "The answer is all of them. Don't be selfish with your work. Let other people explore your work, at the very least after your death when you're not around to complain. Imagine if Beethoven destroyed the sheet music to his pieces so no one else could play his music after his death. He could be all, oh, people wouldn't play it correctly, so I have to destroy the sheet music so my music sounds the best only when I play it, and if I'm dead, well, then that's too bad for them." Look, I'm sure Beethoven would complain when artists use his music as a sample in their latest club tune, but that's the thing, he's not around to do that. So, for me, I just lost a lot of respect for Mike Batt, and I hope that once he peacefully passes from this world due to old age, music artists will create new Wumble songs just out of spite. Shame on you, Mike Batt. Shame on you. And now that my rant on Mike Batt's selfishness is over, let's return to the reason why we're all here. The Wombles arriving at the Eurovision stage. With the Wombles being supported by the BBC, executive producers most likely just approached the band to become the Interval Act of 1974. The contest was being hosted in Brighton after Luxembourg's refusal to host the contest after their second win. And after all the songs were performed on the stage, the host introduces the Interval Act, the Wombles. The orchestra plays the song Remember You're a Womble, with the band providing vocals along with children's voices. Underground, overground, wombling free, the Wombles of Wimbledon, common are we, making good use of the things that we find, things that the everyday folks leave behind. The studio version of the track spent 31 weeks in the UK album charts, peaking at 18th in July of 1974. To British audiences, I imagine this would have been recognizable, at least to children and parents. But to all the hundreds of millions of watchers and listeners from other countries, this would have been bewildering. But it seems that some people took it in stride, including ABBA. Agnetha was given a Wombles button that she actually wore on her costume during her Eurovision performance. You can't see it very clearly, but it's the larger button on her right, your left-hand side. This was confirmed by Mike Batt on Twitter. Rather than seeing the Wombles on stage, a film card is shown to television viewers. I have no idea what the audience saw, but I imagine they weren't as entertained as TV viewers. The film depicts the Wombles walking around Brighton, either picking up litter or interacting with children, or participating in various activities, ranging from walking in a garden to riding a motorboat, driving in motor vehicles to petting a dog, saying hello to an elderly lady, and spinning around on a little spinning top attraction thing like a teacup ride but with arms. The film ends and shows Mike Batt in a Wombles costume, approaching the host, handing her a flower, and holding up a sign on a stick with the words, "Vote for the Wombles." "I'm happy to vote for the Wombles, just not for you, Mr. Batt. I'm still salty from earlier." Overall, I hope the decision to use the Wombles as an interval act is an attempt to showcase the UK as a child-friendly country with wholesome values, rather than trying to capitalize on a children's character who is popular in the UK and practically nowhere else. It's aged pretty badly, still being just as obscure to me as it was in 1974 for outside viewers of the UK. It's an enjoyable song. The film is quite lighthearted and it keeps me occupied. And compared to the interval act from the year before, it's certainly more child-focused and approachable. If Junior Eurovision existed in 1974, then this would be the perfect interval act. Personally, I would have preferred to have seen the Wombles on the stage with children having fun with them, but the children on the film looked like they were having a great time. There's actually a comment that I managed to find on a forum by someone online who claims to have been in the film for the interval act. Someone named Carolyn Siam commented, "I took part in the filming of Remember You're a Womble with the Wombles along Brighton's seafront. I was 10 years old. I belonged to Radio Brighton's Saturday Morning Kids Club and we were asked by Mike Batt to do the filming. It was a brilliant day." It's nice to see people involved in the filming using a kids club to have them involved in something as large as the interval act, and I'm glad that the kids had a good time. Overall, for what it was put well together. Nothing too complicated, and it's more on the simpler side, but it's definitely not the laziest interval act I've ever seen. After the Eurovision Song Contest, the Wombles, as in the band, continued until 1976 when they split following a severe drought that summer, with Wellington Womble, played by Chris Spedding, released the single Rainmaker. I don't believe the drought was the actual cause of the split, but it just happened to coincide with that. The Wikipedia article is worded very strangely in that regard. The band became active again for brief periods between 1998 to 2001 and 2010 to 2017, where most notably Mike Batt and Chris Spedding played at the Avalon Tent at the Gladstonebury Festival in June 2011. Apparently, the founder of the festival, Michael Avis, regretted booking the Wombles, where he was quoted in a BBC article saying it was a mistake. Quote, "I've got about 25 stages and managers and bookers for each of the stages. I can't control every single one of them, but I do get cross about that kind of thing." Of course, Mike Batt defends the Wombles, as in the band, giving a lighthearted response to the critique. Quote, "Uncle Bulgaria told me he thinks Mr. Avis is probably perfectly aware that festivals like his are so popular because they offer an eclectic mix for everybody. It isn't very nice to think that you have been booked at a festival where you aren't welcome, but we hope Mr. Avis will pop along to the Avalon stage on Sunday to check out the reaction for himself. We might even give him a glass of Madame Chollet's special dandelion cordial. Contrary to what he says, the Avalon is a substantial stage, and there is huge excitement about the Wombles' appearance." The band has been dormant since 2017, but the Wombles live on. In 1996, Filmfare was acquired by a Canadian company called Cinar Films, and a new series of the Wombles was created with three new characters. This show ran for three series, totaling 52 episodes, running on Britain's ITV network from 1997 to 2000. The Wombles also had a feature-length live-action movie called Wombling Free in 1977, and some sporting teams that represent Wimbledon are sometimes nicknamed the Wombles, including the ladies' side of Wimbledon RFC, the Wimbledon Volleyball Club, and the Wombles Netball Club. The Wombles also have a merchandise line, which only took off after Star Wars was able to capitalize the market of merchandise. Demand for Wombles merch in the UK rose steadily along with the success of the franchise, but restrictions on toy advertising in the United Kingdom kept TV merchandise sales in check. Some of the products include stuffed toys, stationery, stickers, small figurines, bath soap, nightlights, lampshades, chocolate bars, gelatin pudding kits, posters, games, shirts, badges and buttons, cloth patches, and other items. The revival of the series in the late 1990s brought with it another wave of merchandise, which included lunchboxes, umbrellas, flannel face cloths, hot water bottle covers, slippers, a Steiff doll, whatever that is, and a set of postage stamps for Alderney. That's a lot of merchandise for a brand that I have never heard of, but I guess it was popular enough to warrant the creation of so much merchandise. After the Wombles, Elizabeth Beresford moved her family to Alderney, which is one of the Channel Islands, in the 1970s. In 1984, Elizabeth divorced her husband and went on to create other novels for children, many of which were based on the island she lived on. She actually lived in a 300-year-old cottage, which I think is quite cool. She collaborated with Jane Ayrton on children's television series. And in the 1998 New Year's Honours list, she was made a member of the Order of the British Empire for her services to children's literature. Elizabeth recalls the interaction she had with Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, saying, quote, When I went to get my MBE from the Queen, she talked nonstop about them. She knew more about the Womels than I did. She said to me, "Personally, I always had a lot of trouble with Bungo because I can't understand why he should be so bossy. What has he got to be so bossy about?" She went on, and I just sat there saying, "Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am." Despite moving on to other endeavors, Elizabeth never really stopped her work with the Wombles. She embarked to a number of international destinations, reading to children around the world. Elizabeth recalls two particular stories which touched her the most. The first is when she traveled to South Africa, encountering a tribe of Zulu people. Quote, "As soon as I walked in and saw them, I knew jolly well there was no way I could explain the Wombles to them. So I started with, 'Once there lived an old man.' That was Great Uncle Bulgaria, and I managed to drag it out. At the end, the Zulus gave their traditional applause, which was to chant and pretend to throw spears. My guide said it was time to retreat, one step at a time." The second was during the height of the troubles in Ireland and Northern Ireland. Elizabeth traveled to Belfast and agreed to do so on the condition that she would read Womble stories to both Catholic and Protestant children together in one room. Each night she went, she was taken in the middle of the night to a different safe house. So not only did she manage to reach out to different communities around the world, she actually helped to foster relations between Catholic and Protestant children, especially during an extremely challenging time in Ireland's history. Elizabeth Beresford died on December 24, 2010 at 10:30 p.m. in Alderney's Mignot Memorial Hospital, with the cause of death being heart failure. She was 84 years old. Mike Batt is still alive as of the recording of this episode, aged 74. And that is the story of The Wombles, a children's novel turned TV show, music band, and wide-reaching franchise beloved by so many people, ranging from children in remote areas to Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. Their appearance on the Eurovision stage as an interval act is but a small blip in their story, and their reach extends far beyond the Eurovision stage. Just as we remember that we too can be Wombles, we remember that Eurovision 2024 is coming ever so closer. So let's turn ourselves to some Eurovision news. It's time for the Eurovision Report. San Marino's national final, Una Voce per San Marino, has shifted its date for the grand final, moving the date a week earlier from March 2nd to February 24th, with regulations not ruling out other possible reschedulings. The grand final will take place at the Teatro Nuovo di Dogana, the same venue used in previous Una Voce per San Marino national finals. 16 participants will compete in the final, with 8 emerging artists qualifying through the semifinal system, and 8 established acts auto-qualifying. This is reported by Fotios Nitinos of EurovisionFun.com. SVT announced that an additional wave of tickets will be offered for the Eurovision Song Contest 2024, as tickets to the show sold out quickly. Ebba Adelson, the executive producer of Eurovision 2024, said in a statement, "It's great fun with the great interest, and of course we want to offer as many people as possible to see one of the 9 shows between May 6th and 11th. For production technical reasons, we could not release all tickets now. More tickets will be offered in the future, so those who did not get a ticket now will have a new chance." The EBU will be putting additional limits in place to slow down the pace of ticket sales to ensure the sales take place in a safe and secure manner. This is reported by Sanjay Giandani of ESC Today. This has been the Eurovision Report. Now it's time for Song of the Week. This is the part of the show where I share a Eurovision entry that I find entertaining or perhaps boring. Maybe it's iconic or completely forgettable. Let's find out which entry gets Song of the Week. This week's Song of the Week is the 1962 entry for Switzerland, Le Retour, The Return. Singer Jean Philippe, composer Gilles Vumard, lyricist Émile Gardaz, conducted by Cédric Dumont. This entry placed joint 10th, with Denmark and Norway getting only 2 points from Germany. I'm personally surprised that Jean-Philippe didn't sue the James Bond franchise for copyright infringement, as this song sounds exactly like a James Bond theme song would sound like. The 1962 Eurovision Song Contest took place on March 18, 1962, and the first James Bond filmed, Dr. No, was released on October 5, 1962 in the UK, almost 7 months after this song debuted. Almost no one remembers Jean-Philippe, yet everyone remembers James Bond. This song is fantastic. Despite sounding like a James Bond theme song, the song itself is about le retour, the return to love. Lyrics on the Diggy Loo Thrush website, translated by Carlos Martinez, reads, "By searching too much, we wasted what we had better kept in our eyes. And there you see where the short walk brought us. Everyone gets his turn. It's the return." The song expresses the longing to return to the thing that we search for, how we have wasted the best time of our lives searching for it, but at the end of the day, everyone gets their return, and in this case, it's the return of new days. The song is enjoyable, mysterious to those who don't understand French, and honestly, it came way too low in my opinion. There were only 16 countries competing that year, with most of the points going to France, Monaco, Luxembourg, the UK, and Yugoslavia, with the remaining 11 countries fighting for the scraps of points remaining. And 4 of those 11 countries didn't even get any points at all. This is a victim of a terrible voting system, which thankfully did not last very long. Jean-Philippe's song, which in my delusional opinion inspired the James Bond theme songs of today, gets Song of the Week. Remember You're a Womble. The Wombles sound like a beautiful children's story turned into a wholesome television and film program encouraging children to keep the planet clean, especially during the start of environmental activism in the 1960s and 1970s. While part of the Wombles' story has been lost forever due to the selfish actions of a desperate music producer, their legacy goes beyond the Eurovision Song Contest, and they remain in the hearts of Brits and I'm sure fans around the world. I'll never forget that I am a Womble now. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch with your thoughts and comments on this week's episode or anything else, you can reach out to the Instagram account for ESC101 at ESC101podcast. You can also send an email to ESC101podcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to read the articles referenced in today's episode, check out the show notes page on our website, ESC101podcast.wordpress.com. Be sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform so other Eurovision history fans can find us. And check out our previous episodes if you'd like to hear more stories on Eurovision history and obscurity. For those of you on Spotify, I've launched a little poll and Q&A segment if you're interested in voicing your opinions and your vote on questions related to this week's episode. Check it out and feel free to share your thoughts with us. Next week, we are checking out a series of postcards, the little segments shown in between acts, so stay tuned to find out which year we'll be exploring next. You've been listening to ESC 101. See you next time.